It is 5 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ray Kugel reporting. Wreckage from an Indonesian passenger plane found. 54 people were aboard that plane. The wreckage located in the rugged eastern province of Papua. The plane crashed Sunday while flying through bad weather. Officials say rescue teams are working to get to the site of the debris field. It's still not known if anyone survived. Trigana Air Flight 267 lost contact with air traffic control about 30 minutes after Sunday's takeoff from Sentani Airport in the provincial capital, Jayapura. The plane was on what is normally a 50-minute flight to the city of Auxerre. The crash site is about 12 kilometers from there. At least 80 people were killed in Syria Sunday in Syrian government airstrikes in the rebel-held town of Douma near Damascus. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights Monitoring Group says another 200 people were wounded, mainly civilians. Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi agreed on Sunday with an investigative commission's recommendation to court-martial Iraqi commanders who withdrew from Ramadi earlier this year, as that city fell to Islamic State militants. Taking the capital of Iraq's western Anbar province was a big victory for Islamic State fighters, giving them control of a major city 125 kilometers from Baghdad. Regional leaders are pushing South Sudan's government and rebels to seal a peace agreement today to end their 20-month civil war. President Salva Kiir and his chief rival, rebel leader Riek Machar, are both in Addis Ababa for talks brokered by the East African Bloc IGAD. Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta is taking part in the talks, along with Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir, Uganda's President Museveni, and Ethiopia's Prime Minister. This is VOA News. The Home Minister of Pakistan's Punjab province was killed in a suicide bombing Sunday. At least 14 others were also killed in that attack, about 100 kilometers northwest of Islamabad. Ayaz Gul reports.
Witnesses say the deceased minister, Shuja Khanzada, was listening to complaints of villagers at his residence in the Attock district when a suicide bomber detonated explosives strapped to his body. The massive blast caused the building to collapse and trap dozens of people under the rubble. Provincial advisor Saeed Elahi says civilian and military rescue teams quickly reached the site to retrieve bodies and assist the wounded.
But as you know, there's a congested small town. The narrow streets and the blocked roads, so that was a problem, reaching there.
Minister Khanzada was leading a crackdown against militants linked to the Pakistani Taliban and Al-Qaeda in the province. Ayaz Gul for VOA News, Islamabad.
Tens of thousands of protesters took to the streets across Brazil Sunday calling for the impeachment of President Dilma Rousseff because of a corruption scandal along with the country's sputtering economy and rising inflation. Much of the public anger toward Ms. Rousseff stems from revelations of a kickback scheme at state-run oil company Petrobras, which prosecutors call the biggest corruption scheme ever uncovered in Brazil. Dozens of political figures, including close allies of the president and former Petrobras executives, are under investigation. Billionaire real estate mogul Donald Trump, still the front runner in the race for the 2016 Republican presidential nomination, says if elected, illegal immigrants will have to leave the United States. In an interview on NBC's Meet the Press Sunday, Mr. Trump vowed to build an impenetrable wall along the U.S.-Mexican border, and in his words, nobody's getting through that wall. On other foreign policy matters, Mr. Trump spoke about Iran and ISIS.
And I said Iran will take over Iraq, which is happening, as sure as you're sitting there. And ISIS is taking over a lot of the oil in certain areas of Iraq. And I said, you take away their wealth. You go and knock the hell out of the oil, take back the oil. We take over the oil, which we should have done in the first place.
Mr. Trump also called U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry incompetent for his negotiations to restrain Iran's nuclear program. And he predicted that Iran will end up being nuclear. The Arab League is scheduled to hold an emergency meeting Tuesday. It comes at the request of Libya's internationally recognized government. The Tobruk-based government asked for help from regional allies, including airstrikes. The request follows dozens of deaths last week in the coastal city of Sirte. That is where a group, including local residents, attacked Islamic State fighters. The militants took over the city in June. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Monday, August 17th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Today is the deadline for South Sudan's warring parties to reach an agreement that would end the country's 20-month-old civil war.
Nobody can speculate that there will be agreement on Monday, because the agreement actually depends on good faith negotiations of the outstanding issues between the two principals, our chairman, Dr. Riek Machar, and Salva Kiir of the regime.
Stephen Paul Kuol is the spokesman for rebels loyal to former South Sudan Vice President Riek Machar. A South Sudan bishop makes a last-ditch effort for appeal for peace in South Sudan. Liberian women want equal representation in all sectors of society, and Burundi's foreign minister says his country is doing all it can to restore stability.
I have to stress that despite what some might think, there's some sort of engagement going on in the country with respect to the formation of the government of national unity, as it has been recommended by the region.
Alain Nyamitwe is Burundi's foreign minister. Angola sees extraordinary development, but some activists are concerned about the high cost. And a new movie is seen as a lightning rod for police brutality in the United States. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Today, Monday, is the deadline set by African leaders and the international community for South Sudan's warring parties to reach a peace agreement that would end the country's 20-month-old civil war. President Salva Kiir arrived in Addis Ababa Sunday, less than 2 days after he canceled the planned trip over concerns that rebel factions had split apart and would not present a united front. Rebel spokesman Stephen Paul Kuol says there is no split in the rebel movement, but rather a defection by what he calls two disgruntled generals. He says there can be no agreement if the two sides cannot agree on the key issues of this agreement, which are security arrangements, federalism, and power sharing.
Well, you know, nobody can speculate that there will be agreement on Monday, because the agreement actually depends on good faith negotiations of the outstanding issues between the two principals, our chairman, Dr. Riek Machar, and Salva Kiir of the regime. But I'm telling you that we cannot sign an agreement alone. We cannot make peace without the other side. The two delegations have negotiated. We have reached deadlock on key issues of security arrangement, federalism, which is the system of governance, and the power sharing. Those are outstanding issues of this negotiation. We have transferred this to the mediation and the principal to negotiate them further. This is the schedule, and the schedule deadline is Monday, the 17th. We are meeting that on our side, but I don't see the government meeting the deadline.
Some people would say that your leader, Riek Machar, was the first to signal that the talks will fail by saying that President Salva Kiir and President Museveni of Uganda colluded to sabotage the talks.
You know, for your information, Salva Kiir and Yoweri Museveni have been doing a lot of forum shopping, trying to run away from the main forums of Addis Ababa. And the Kampala Forum, created by the two, came up with a resolution to alter the framework of the main forum here in Addis. And we have made that very clear from day one, whether it is a forum taking place in Addis or anywhere. As long as Uganda, which is actually a warring party in this conflict, is a part of it, we will not be part of it. There is no way we will keep quiet when Museveni is creating a forum that provides a resolution altering the main framework of the IGAD Plus, which is this compromise document. The framework we will work with is the compromise document. And the only forum we will really participate in is this IGAD Plus forum in Addis Ababa.
The former foreign minister of Ethiopia, who is now the chief IGAD mediator, Seyoum Mesfin, has said that you, the opposition, and the South Sudan government will have to sign an agreement, or you will not leave Addis Ababa.
Well, I don't know what that means. What I can tell you is that we have come voluntarily to Addis Ababa to make peace. And we have done all we can as a party. Our delegation, under the leadership of Governor Thabandeng, negotiated with the government delegation. We finished that part. So we have been more than ready for that. We have done that part. The remaining part is that of the two principals. And our principal has been here, seen them. So this thing that none of us is leaving Addis is what we have seen as, this blanket blame for failures.
Stephen Paul Cool is the spokesman for Rebels Loyal to former South Sudan Vice President Riek Machar. He was speaking with me from the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. Roman Catholic Bishop Edward Hiboro of the Diocese of Nyambio Tambura is appealing for calm in Western Equatorial State after President Salva Kiir Sunday fired the state governor in a presidential decree. The president gave no reasons for Governor Joseph Bakasoro's dismissal, but Bishop Hiboro says men in military uniform picked up Governor Bakasoro on Sunday night from his house and took him to an unknown location in Juba. He calls on President Kiir and rebel leader Riek Machar to sign a peace deal today, Monday, so as to restore peace to the whole of South Sudan.
President Salva Kiir, peace has a price. He must pay a price for this peace. And the same for Riek. They must pay a price, let go certain things, and I'm telling you, they will get over these things and will work, move well. To all those states where governors have been changed, I ask people, that's not the end of the road for Central Equatoria, for Warab, for Western Equatoria and Malakal. You don't need to stop there and say, okay, this governor, we loved him, he has been removed, and then you take law in your hands. No, we accept what has happened and look for a bigger picture where we will have a time. Democracy will prevail in the country. You choose your leaders and the country will move ahead. So my appeal to all of us is to hold on together as the people of South Sudan, put our country ahead of everything, see the beauty of it, and therefore it will call on us to do the right thing to keep it peaceful.
And with this latest development, with the governor of Western Equatoria, Colonel Joseph Bakasoro, has been relieved from his position as the governor of the state, do you see any implication of this reshuffle on what has been happening there on the ground?
Let us think that the government has a goodwill to do this, but this is not the best time to make such changes when people are looking to bigger peace. It disturbs people's mind. And I think things like, why not consult? I mean, there are community leaders, there are opinion leaders in the state. Listen to people, listen to communities.
Let's talk about what is happening in Addis Ababa here. You've been here for quite a long time. Have you had any messages of peace, any messages of love from the political leaders, from both the SPLM in opposition and the government? What are they saying?
We are putting pressure on, you know, they must sign. But there's no agreement signed by force. If it is signed by force, then you will need also force to help to implement it. So that's the logic. So for me, I'm afraid that the agreement that might be signed, if it is signed under pressure, let us be sure it is not going to be implemented well. I will only suggest that let this not be the end of the road. If the peace is not signed, we should not get discouraged. People should remain focused and continue to work and see what to do in order to bring peace to the country.
That was Bishop Edward Hiboro of the Roman Catholic Diocese of Nyambio Tamburu in South Sudan. He spoke with in Addis Ababa with John Tanza of View South Sudan in Focus program. Burundi's foreign minister says his government is doing its utmost to ensure that the country does not degenerate into an all-out ethnic conflict by making sure that those who perpetrate violence are brought to book. Alain Nyamitwe says President Pierre Nkurunziza has also promised to unveil a national unity government within the next few days in line with the Arusha Peace Accord and as recommended by leaders of the East African community. His comments came after African Union Commission Chair Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma warned on Sunday that the political crisis in Burundi could have catastrophic consequences for the country and the surrounding region. Nyamitwe says President Nkurunziza could unveil his new cabinet after he sworn in on August 26.
Well, I can only say that our hope and prayer is that our country does not slide to the extent of collapsing into a generalized conflict. We are doing our utmost to make sure that the killings stop, that the perpetrators are arrested and brought to book. Now, I also agree that it is imperative to have different stakeholders get into deep discussions and conversations on the issues that divide them. But I have to stress that despite what some might think, there's some sort of engagement going on in the country with respect to the formation of the government of national unity, as it has been recommended by the region.
Mr. Minister, this is also coming at the time that last week the United Nations, the African Union, even the European Union tended to blame your government for what they thought as moving away from the Arusha Accord, which respects the ethnic division of your country.
First of all, I completely disagree the way you have put it. I do not think that the international community as a whole has castigated Burundi as not being implementing the Arusha Accord. I think it's only one country, one government, which has said so. Now, for those who say so, I wish to remind them that the Arusha Accord has set a number of principles and a number of, I'll say, quotas that need to be implemented in the institutions. As we speak, after the elections which were held on 29th of June, on the 21st of July and 24th of July, the parliamentary institutions, that is the House of Reps and the Senate, have now been put in place. And in both bodies, the Arusha Accord has been fully respected, and even beyond the quotas that have been enshrined in our constitution.
Mr. Minister, so where is your government now in terms of forming a government after the last controversial election? Are you making progress, or as some people would say, there's chaos?
Where do you get those words again? You see, what I don't understand is that some actors in the international community think that they have the right to lecture other nations on the way they govern. I can tell you that when it comes to the formation of the government of national unity, as His Excellency the head of state has accepted to form such government, the discussions are underway, and I can tell you that we are making progress. In a few days from now, you'll be informed fully about the new cabinet. I can absolutely tell you here that that government will comprise not only members from the ruling party, but also people from the opposition. Meanwhile, some of those who are criticizing us do not respect the same quotas or the same figures in their own institutions. How many women do you have in the parliament in the United States of America? Or how many black people versus white people do you have in the parliament in America? Why should some be lecturing other countries on the way they govern?
Alain Nyamitwe is Burundi's foreign minister. He was speaking with me from the capital, Bujumbura. Today is Monday, August 17th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 18 minutes past the hour. Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf has told Liberian women they can change the world if they act together and support each other. She reportedly made the comment Sunday after women from across the country gave her a statement calling for equal representation in government, women land rights, health care, and employment and empowerment. Following a two-day retreat which focused on issues affecting women, Julia Duncan Cassell is Liberia's Minister of Gender and Development. She says the women want to make sure that the gains made since 2005 are not thrown out the window when President Sirleaf leaves office.
Right now in Liberia, we are going through the constitutional review. The issues that women would like to see captured in the constitutional review when it goes to the legislature, and how the women can be involved in the awareness and education of our people, ensuring that when it goes to referendum, they can go out in mass number and vote on the issues that affect just not the women, but the family or Liberians as a whole.
Is it an indication that the women of Liberia feel that their representation, for example, in government, equal empowerment, that these are not being realized?
To some extent, but this is to say that what has been realized since 2005 need to be improved on. Continuity is equally important. What will happen after Madam Sirleaf, when she is gone and he comes on board? Where will the women play? Where will the women be? Yes, there are a lot of things that they could have been involved in, but looking forward now, so the women have said to themselves, this is time that we come together and speak with one voice to ensure more women are elected in parliament, more women are involved from local government to national government, that the rights of women are protected, that FGBV is top and priority of what is happening in Liberia.
The president reminded you, the women, that some of the concerns you expressed are now being debated in the Constitutional Review Committee conference that was held in Banga. Is there a concern that those recommendations made in Banga may not pass?
Yes, to a greater extent there are concerns because it's been presented to the president. The president has to look at it, have a legal advisors look at it, because the constitution is not a book, you just put anything. So it has to be concise. So our concern is that when they get to the legislature, those recommendations should still be in there. So we want to raise the awareness, we want to make sure that we have it from the highest, which is the president being a female. So those were just some of the concerns of the women, that we're not just going to leave it as is, start making a lot of noise. We're going to increase the awareness on it. We're going to educate the people, go from the hamlet to the village, from the village to the community, from the community to the county level, city level, district level. We're going to go all over to start the awareness and people the right information is that we want in that constitution when it goes to referendum and how they can be part and parcel of it.
Julia Duncan Cassell is Liberia's Minister of Gender and Development. She was speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. A new book describes the African nation of Angola as an economic miracle for its rapid transformation after a brutal civil war. But critics of Angola's long-time government say the high rises and expensive new houses in Angola's capital have come at a high cost. VOA's Anita Powell reports.
In the last decade, Angola has transformed itself from an impoverished, war-torn nation into an economic powerhouse. Its capital, Luanda, is a glittering testament to that. The coastal city is among the most expensive in the world. The nation's oil wealth has brought Lamborghinis to its streets and yachts to its marina. University of Oxford lecturer Ricardo Suarez de Oliveira has written a book on the transformation.
Angola had a civil war that lasted for 41 years and that killed a million people. By the end of it, obviously, Angola was in tatters. What happened over the subsequent decade was absolutely extraordinary. The economy of Angola multiplied tenfold. It was the greatest growth story in the world in the early 21st century.
But Angolan activists say the growth hasn't benefited everyone. Angola is one of the world's most unequal societies. Elias Isak leads the Angola program for the Open Society Initiative for Southern Africa. He says the lightning pace of development has left far too many people behind.
It was necessary, but the problem is the way it was done. It came at the cost of a lot of people have been completely marginalized and excluded from this process.
Among the casualties, say activists, have been human rights and free expression. Human Rights Watch has accused police of using excessive force and arbitrary arrests to stop anti-government protests. And journalist Rafael Marquez de Moraes, who was recently convicted of defamation for a book he wrote on abuses in the diamond fields, questions whether Angola has really developed at all.
What development? That's the question we have to ask. When you build high rises in Africa, especially in countries like Angola, where there's so many, people tend to believe that the high rises translate into development, but that's not true. It has the highest child mortality rate in the world, worse than Afghanistan. What development is that, that we cannot provide the basics to save children?
He says many ordinary Angolans find themselves gazing up from the gutter at the glare of skyscrapers and asking that very same question. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Straight Outta Compton is a docudrama about the rise and fall of N.W.A., the music group that revolutionized hip-hop and rap. The film chronicles the discontent in Compton, a poor inner-city neighborhood of Los Angeles, wedged between gang violence and police abuse, and how hip-hop music expressed the black community's anger and emotions. Penelope Paulu reports.
Where you think you're going?
I'm just trying to get home.
But that's my son!
You need to get back in the house or I will ruin your night.
You ain't gotta talk to
me. In the tough black neighborhood of Compton, it often seemed like a teenager could not leave his house without getting into some kind of trouble with the police or gangsters.
You had the chance to change the situation. Would you take it?
Gary Gray's Straight Outta Compton docudrama shows how that volatile state of affairs became the seedbed of rap music in the 1980s.
Cruising down the street in my 6-4.
And so N.W.A., the first rap group, was born.
You're listening to Compton's very own Ice Cube, Eazy-E, and Dr. Dre. I gotta tell you, you are witnessing history.
The group's tough lyrics on drugs, violence, and poverty, and its visceral music took the world by storm. Filmmaker Gary Gray says he worked hard to keep the story as authentic as possible, actually filming in Compton.
This is not only history, it's American history, it's world history. And so I get a chance to put on my journalist hat and be a historian.
People are scared of you, guys. You have a unique voice. The world needs to hear it.
They want N.W.A.? Let's give them N.W.A.
We put it all in the music, all our frustration and anger.
Ice Cube, now a Hollywood mogul, remembers what it was like.
Our music was like our weapon.
And that's the most powerful weapon we got.
His son, O'Shea Jackson Jr., portrays his father as a young man.
They shed light on things that people needed to know.
Speak a little truth and people lose their minds.
But their lyrics prompted harsh public reaction outside of Compton.
Your songs, they glamorize gangs and drugs.
Our art is a reflection of our reality.
The film focuses on N.W.A.'s rise to fame and follows it through its rifts and final breakup.
Sit tight and let us do our job.
Hey, officer, I'm sorry. What is going
Sir?
On out?
Can you stay right there, please?
But its scenes of police violence are especially hard-hitting after the recent deaths of unarmed black men, such as Michael Brown in Ferguson and Eric Garner in New York City at the hands of police.
Well, you're wasting your time, Mr. Manager.
You gotta be kidding me.
You're wasting your time.
Really?
These clients of yours, these rappers, they look like gang members.
You can't come down here and arrest people just because of what they look like. Are you crazy? But that's police harassment.
Straight Outta Compton has attracted positive reviews for offering an authentic portrayal of N.W.A. and for taking us back to a time when daily violence bred a different kind of music. Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Monday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with the netball. Malawian Mwai Kumwenda was crowned the 2015 Netball World Cup Player of the Tournament in Sydney, Australia on Sunday. Kumwenda stole the limelight after emerging the tournament's top scorer with 321 goals. She is credited with a 91% scoring rate in 8 matches Malawi played at the global contest. Staying in Sydney, South Africa pipped Malawi 48-46 in the 5th place playoff at the Netball World Cup on Sunday. Wales outplayed Uganda 64-41 in the 7th place playoff, while Barbados prevailed over Zambia 53-38 in the 13th place playoff. Earlier on, tournament debutants Zambia salvaged a measure of national pride with their first two triumphs on the world stage when they dismissed Sri Lanka 70-36 and Singapore 67-36 in classification ties on Saturday and Friday, respectively. Australia won the World Cup, New Zealand placed second, England a bronze medalist, and Jamaica fourth. Turning to handball, Egypt put up a brave fight before going down 31-26 to Sweden as Tunisia lost 28-14 to Denmark in the round of 16 at the Men's Youth World Handball Championships in Yekaterinburg, Russia on Sunday. Earlier on Friday, Tunisia edged Japan 29-26 as Egypt pipped Germany 24-23 to ensure an African presence in the knockout stage of the tournament, while Croatia dismissed Algeria 32-22. Moving on to volleyball, Algeria outclassed hosts Morocco in straight sets of 26-24, 25-22 and 26-24 to clinch their first Arab Boys Youth Volleyball Championship title in Sahel on Friday. It's also Morocco's first appearance in the finals of the biannual contest. Qatar outplayed Tunisia 28-26, 25-20 and 25-16 to retain the bronze medal they first won in Tunisia 2 years ago. Finally in football, Tunisia hosts Morocco in an Orange African Nations Championship qualifier in Tunis today, Monday. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a very good day. And that's it for this Monday, August 17th edition of Daybreak Africa. I'm James Butte in Washington saying, have a lovely day, Africa.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa. Tanzanian President Jakaya Kikwete's second five-year term is nearly over. On October 25th, the nation's voters head to the polls to choose a leader. Join host Shaka Sali and his guests for an in-depth discussion on the Tanzanian elections and the role of the opposition in the upcoming vote. That's next time on VOA Africa. VOA